just real quickly, if you could sort of catch me up on how you got involved with the summer project.
Yeah.
Who first approached you?
Well, part of this is part of the whole history of my work, which is a little bit of it is in the first volume of Children of Crisis. I describe how I got involved with all of this. But I specifically got involved with SNCC through one of the 10 students who initiated school desegregation in Atlanta, who was a high school student who worked with SNCC. And he told me to go down there and maybe I could get to know some of them and volunteer. He, in other words, he had in mind for me to volunteer and work with them rather than to do any kind of social or psychiatric study. But I, at the time, I think I've described this in some of the writing I've done. I mean, Jim Foreman put me to work sweeping floors, so you've read that. And so by the time I had been with SNCC for 2 years before the Mississippi Summer Project, at a time when SNCC was not as, in any way, as well known as it became by the end of 63 and into 64. Simply because I knew some of the Atlanta high school kids who had also gotten involved, and so I knew, just the whole range of them, all of them. I was kind of part of that. That's why I think Bob would tell you that I was there for 2 weeks helping them out, and I think it's hard to talk without sounding self-serving, but I think factually, for a while at least, I was fairly trusted as much as a white person ever could be. Now, we know that by the end of 64, no white person, I mean, that's what had already taken place. And I was never, though, as ideological and as totally with the whole civil rights movement and some aspects of it as, say, Howard Zinn or Stoughton Lynn, because I think my politics are more cranky and difficult. I mean, the people that I admire ultimately like Dorothy Day and Chavez and but also Robert Kennedy and more in the more political literature of people like Orwell and Ignazio Salone. I don't know if you've read Bread and Wine. Dolce. I mean, these are people who were Irving Howe's called the homeless left. And if you're a member of the homeless left and you start noticing a particular political movement get ideological and blacks turning on whites and all, I was appalled and horrified and could not defend it. And I could not defend the way ultimately they turned on one another. And if I have to say so myself, that article, Social Struggle and Weariness, which after all was published in 1963, was a little prophetic about what was happening, the bitterness, the anger, the meanness. And I know that the political theorists would claim that I'm a typical liberal ideologue in my own way because of the way I react about those things, but I do, and I, you know, those are my limitations, and that's what began to horrify me. However, that we're jumping a bit. In any event, I remember Bob Moses and I, Green, Charlie Green was his friend. I mean, I remember when they went to Macomb in 63 and came back to Atlanta and I talked with them. Ultimately, I think I went myself to Macomb. I was in one of the freedom houses that was dynamited, fell apart there. But I forgot whether that was in 64 or 66. It was 64. It was
64.
Yeah. But I remember when they came back and I remember when they began to talk about this 64 project and how much it meant to them and how they would take on the Capitol. It was like storming the Winter Palace. They would help it.
And so this would have been in the fall of 63.
This would have been the fall of 63.
Now, did you
in Atlanta.
At that sense, did you sense any division in the SNCC
staff?
No,
at that time, probably I was dumb and couldn't pick it up. I know there were tensions between people and various intrigues, human intrigues, I would call them, rather than political intrigues, and that's an important distinction. Human intrigues, for God's sakes, it's a group of people. There were, you know, by this time, even in the Atlanta office, there must have been 30 or 40 people prating in and out at various times. Dottie Zellner, do you know the name? Bob Zellner. I was very close to Dottie for a while. She'd come down from the north. Her father was a dentist in New York, and they would ultimately get married. But I mean, some of the first interviews I did was with Bob Zellner, who was most revered of the white people
right.
for a while, at least, and who was in New Orleans. Have you tried to reach them?
No.
And as a labor organizer, and she with them. But I would call them human intrigues, pettiness that we're all capable of. You see them certainly in these kinds of intrigues among psychoanalyzed shrinks. So why should these kids be entitled to them? And among highfalutin college professors. So again, you don't make any special case out of that, although I think social sciences can make a special case out of everything.
Right.
And shrinks especially. In any event, that's what I would call it. I saw none of that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Foreman get pushy and bossy, and I saw Bob's almost Gandhi-like qualities from the very beginning. He, at the time, was married to a very difficult woman. And how are you going to bring this up? I don't think you really can. I would not want what I'm saying now to be very difficult. And she was part of this. I mean, those are the kinds of things that someone
right.
like me was noticing at that time.
Okay. Well, do you remember when the sort of formal planning started for the, let's say, orientation sessions?
Winter and spring of 64, and I very clearly remember that.
And now, were you actually part of the actual planning of the session?
I think so. I don't think I have any risk of being self-serving here. I've noticed in some of the write-ups that they don't mention me, which is fine. I mean, but I don't care to be. But I think the record would show that I was part of that. That I was a psychiatrist and the only one basically that they knew to trust that would work with them. And I don't know, you should ask Bob this, but as I recall it, with all the risks of pride and egotism involved, I think I was fairly close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do recall them really wanting me to come out there and spend that 2 weeks and really feeling that I had something to offer after they were suddenly confronted with all these upper middle class white kids, and I suppose to be blunt about it, I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, older.
Right.
And for no other reason, I'm being a little shrinky now, for no other reason, I couldn't help them understand what the struggle was in the South, because they knew a hell of a lot more about that than I did. But I did know, having gone to Harvard and being the product of what I am, as you can see, right, coming out here, I think that they felt that I could help them with that. And there were some kids who were a little shaky psychologically. Not that I was ever formally, although if you read the write-ups at that time, I think I was called the snake shrink and all
mm-hmm.
that stuff. But that's, yes, I think I very much was involved with them. I don't know whether Bob will remember this, but there was a very dramatic moment in Oxford when some social scientists from the University of Wisconsin wanted to do some work.
Michael Aiken and...
Yeah, and they wouldn't let them.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately the decision was Bob's, and he turned to me and he said to me, very gently, he said, what do you think? And I at the time felt no, that I don't think they should be around
mm-hmm.
doing questionnaires. And my purpose, I don't think it was competitive, that I didn't want social scientists. I felt that to start making for self-consciousness about among people who are going to be facing danger, I objected to that very much.
But do you think, let's back
just one minute.
Okay.
So my sons are coming in and out of the
okay.
house, and I just want to check.
Were you involved in the actual recruiting at all? Did you interview?
No.
Okay.
Not to the initial recruiting.
Okay. Do you think? Did you hear any discussions about that? Do you think they were happy with the recruiting, or?
I remember them being happy with some and unhappy even from day one in Oxford with others. A few who were already. Well, there was one girl I remember whose father was actually a psychiatrist in Chicago who was, she was a difficult person, and I thought somewhat depressed, although not as nearly as depressed as her parents were, who were calling up constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some kids who were frightened. But by and large, this was not a group of people that you needed a lot of psychiatric nursing
mm-hmm.
for. Some of them were arrogant, were protected by their ignorance and arrogance, to be blunt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were protected, in the best sense of the word, protection by a kind of earnest goodwill. Some of them were a bit show-offy, some of them were naive and presumptuous, but so were we all, mm-hmm. black and white,
right.
one another.
So, were you there the whole two weeks?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And as I told you, I knew Mickey Schwerner, I knew Andy Goodman and Shaney, and in fact, they joked with me, they wanted me to get on with them, because Andy's mother was a psychologist in New York still. And Mickey was a psychiatric social worker, and they joked with me that I could make, we could have a team, you know, the doctor, the social worker, the psychologist by extension. And I remember as clear as if it were today, saying goodbye to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember what happened when we found out that they were not. You see, they kept very close tabs on all these people, and in that sense, they knew the dangers. But I'm not sure the students knew that. This is the ethical problem.
Well, let's talk about the second training period first, since we're on that. Do you remember who announced the initial disappearance to the group?
I seem to remember Bob doing, but I may be wrong. Mm-hmm.
I've got conflicting reports,
yeah.
whether it was Moses or Leo Schwerner.
I remember it being Bob.
Okay.
And I remember discussing it with him, and I remember discussing with him what would be done. And then I remember all of us around in a big circle holding hands and singing, "We Shall Overcome."
Mm-hmm. That would be the first night that you would have found that out?
Yes.
Okay. At that point, do you think it was a disappearance, or was it implied there was more? I mean, what was the message?
I think they felt that they were killed.
The staff did, but what do you think the Vogue did?
I don't, oh no, they didn't.
They didn't?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, frankly, I didn't, even though I've lived in Mississippi for 2 years, after all, in the Air Force, and I'd been down south by this time for 6 years, and was not exactly a fool, but I couldn't believe it. Coming out of, look, when I was in that Macomb, did you read the book by Nick von Hoffman, Mississippi Diary? I mean, he describes a little thing with me, where the sheriff had threatened to arrest me. Now, you see, it was inconceivable to me that I'd ever be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that even if a sheriff threatened to arrest me, that he'd never go through with it, or even if he did go through with it, that I'd ever be hurt. And I think that was the way a lot of these kids, they come from very privileged backgrounds. As soon as that dynamiting occurred, I went and phoned my wife, who happened to be related to a United States senator at the time, and I said, you know, if you don't hear from me immediately, you know, so there was this kind of arrogance,
mm-hmm.
and self-importance that people like me feel, and I think a lot of those kids were from very well-established families, and I think they felt no one would dare touch them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may be unfair to them, but it isn't unfair to at least some of them,
right.
I remember. And then there's a natural denial that we all resort to. Who's going to think you're going to die? No one does.
Mm-hmm.
I go into the psychiatric language of denial and all this stuff, but the fact is that most of them definitely mm-hmm. were sure that somehow they'd surface in a day or two. But this was what stunned me, is the way Bob, Stokely Carmichael, and Foreman, and others there, especially Foreman and Bob, I remember being quite convinced that they might well be there now. Maybe they don't remember it that way, but mm-hmm. I remember noticing the disparity between the way they felt, the ominous, but also, of course, there was another side to this that I also noticed, that in a strange way, I think they may have felt that this was going to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And that also began to dawn on me for the first time only then, which probably was a reminder to me that I didn't understand their thinking as well as I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
How could I, being the kind of person I am and coming from the life that I come from, I'm not a political person in ways, and at least in that way, a political person like, oh, manipulate middle-class people within professions and occupations and whatever. But something had failed as far as my awareness of what... I just remember being stunned that, in fact, quickly attention started zeroing in on this, and the more the attention zeroed in, the more, of course, they were realizing that they'd already succeeded before we even went down south.
Mm-hmm.
because this became cover stories in news magazines, and the President of the United States was having to say. So they'd won.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor of Mississippi as much as acknowledged that they'd won within a week or two before the... Yet, in a strange way, there had to be deaths.
Right.
And this they, I think, consciously knew. I have no right to speak for other people. But I would be wanting to, again, off the record in a way, I'm not off the record for what you're writing, and I, at the risk of arrogance and ignorance on my own part, substantial risks, I would still say that I think they knew when those three were missing that they may well have been killed, and I think they also consciously at the time realized that this would help this project immeasurably.
But I got the feeling that when people write about, they usually write that the staff knew all week, and the clue to them supposedly was the fact that they knew that Shorter and Cheney would never have left the jail at night. They supposedly, this was sort of standards they practiced, and this was their insight that something had gone awry with their sort of elaborate security system,
which was a fairly elaborate system,
right. Well, so then, could you set for me then the tone of the second session then? After that first night, things get on to normal? I mean, was it sort of the same sort of, or was there a different tone now that in terms of the training going on?
They never got back to normal. What happened is that the training was done under the shadow of this event, and I might add, not only the apprehension and anxiety, but the increasing attention. After all, everyone was getting an enormous amount of attention, and here you deal with a phenomenon of a collective celebrity of sorts,
mm-hmm.
namely a project becoming an object of national attention and fame, bringing in all the human emotions connected to that, egotism and self-centeredness and pride, depending on which metaphor you want to use, psychological or theological. But I thought that, I remember that becoming more reporters, television cameras. So in a sense, this became a stage.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't only a training center. It was a stage.
People were conscious of that?
Oh, well, you couldn't help but be. The reporters were all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the television cameras and everything. And big bulletin board, I remember, with articles being posted up from the various newspapers and magazines. So they had the feeling they were taking part in what they were taking part in, a moment of history. But there was a self-consciousness involved, I think accelerated by what had happened there.
Mm-hmm.
Not that everyone isn't self... You have to have some common sense about this. Not that everyone doesn't have self-consciousness anyway,
mm-hmm.
but this was exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a new element in this. And I suppose a measure of the success of the project, since to some extent in American politics, any kind of publicity is always an accelerant, you know what I mean, or an aspect of measures the success of something that is, you know, when you're making a political effort to lobby the Congress as they were making.
But I realize it's difficult to talk about other people, but at the same point that the staff might have sensed that they had won, do you think they were angry over the fact that here with the attention and that the black people have been dying in Mississippi before?
Oh, definitely they were. I remember them saying so.
But did that manifest itself at all, or was sort of?
I think not in any crude or not in any form that could be called a public scene of any kind, and I mean public between combatants or participants or whatever you'd want to call them, this war. No, but I knew it was there and I'd heard it.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it. I think I was close enough to them for them to have said those things, because I did hear it. I don't think they went around making public statements to the other students, although I remember Bob giving a lecture on the state of Mississippi and reminding in his gentle way the listeners that black people have been dying there for a long, long time in an awful, awful ways, and I remember connecting that to what had just happened and noticed and remarking that no one noticed or cared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he might have said that anyway, so you have to be careful. You can't over formula, you
right.
know.
Okay.
But I do remember that because I remember feeling a twinge.
Well, the first training session had seemed to have been marked by a couple of incidents of sort of staff volunteer misunderstanding.
There were a few.
Do you remember, let's say the documentary, we saw the movie on a registrar and a couple of people registering. There seemed to be a lot of laughter. Do you remember that?
I do, but I don't. There were moments of laughter, and there were moments of, you know, some of those kids strutted. I remember hearing Jim talk about that. You know, they were cocky kids from Harvard, Yale, whatever.
Mm.
Some of them from very prominent families, and I think there were class as well as racial tensions.
Mm-hmm.
These are, I remember even an incident over food. You know, complaining about food, and I remember one of the people in Sydney, and I forgot who it was, saying, you know, what do these kids want?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do they think this is? You know, mentioning some fancy restaurant someplace in Atlanta, never mind the fancy ones they might have known in Boston or New York
right.
or whatever. So there was definitely, I do remember some of that, but I don't remember it dominating the whole. By and large, after all, they were there,
mm-hmm.
and they were intent on going south. And even if they were, you know, their clothing, too, everything about them, I mean, they were well-to-do kids, relatively speaking. And they faced the whole world of success.
Mm-hmm.
And here were kids who, not kids, who, you know, kind of different. So there was definitely that. But I don't remember a series of grading incidents, just little moments that would come up about the thing that I mentioned about food and some of the strutting that
mm-hmm.
some of them noticed.
Was there any time an argument about nonviolence?
Not that I remember. The other thing, by the way, is underneath, a novelist would have noticed is here were some very attractive white women. And this was in the days before there was a women's movement. And here was some men, black and white, who were going to be reading them. Well, I thought there was a little undercurrent of that.
Mm-hmm.
Unmentionable subjects.
Right. Right.
But that was not insignificant. You'll notice that I have trouble mentioning it in any of my writing. There are certain things it's very hard to write about, especially if you're white.
Right, white male.
White male.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's a subject too. You probably are not going to get into that, but don't think it was insignificant.
Well, I when I was 2 years ago, took a course called Politics and Libido. And
who gave that?
Dr. Paletz.
P-A-L-E-T-Z.
He's written a book about the media with Edmund and the public policy. Anyway, and I actually used the summer project as a case study in black-white relations. And it was well received at the time, but as I reread it, it's a hopeless mess of social science trouble. But it is a difficult sort of subject to approach. What we were talking about gets into the question of motivation.
Right.
What do you think was the primary motivating force of why those kids were there?
Complex mixture of sometimes contradictory and consistent motivations. I think all that's the trouble with cycle history. It's too formulated and too neat. Categorical. I have to send you. I wrote a whole blast about psycho history, you know. I don't know if you've read it. I described it. There's nothing wrong with using psychology, obviously, but it depends on how you use it. And let me just say this. The motives would go as follows. earnest goodwill and decency and thoughtfulness and sensitivity and compassion, the same kind of motivations that get students to do work in, off campus in Durham or Cambridge or New Haven or Princeton or Chicago or in small towns where the colleges aren't these snotty ones, but I mean, namely, some desire to share one's abilities, skills with other people who need them. Why do students do tutoring? Why do students work in prison? I mean, this kind of youthful idealism.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into other motives. Probably sounds horrible saying so. A summer, boredom, what you do for the summer. Political things. I'm not so sure I agree. Keniston's analysis of this is, I think, confined to a very small group. What he ignores is a lot of the kids who didn't come from these radical families, mm-hmm. liberal families, some of them very deeply Christian, Catholic, or Lutheran families also.
What percentage do you think were?
I don't agree. I don't know whether anyone is ever going to be in a position to give a percentage, but I felt about a third were from that, and those are the people that never get written up.
Right.
The ones who get written up are all these talkative Northeastern liberals and their children and their grandchildren and whatever, because everything they do gets written up. If 50 Harvard students decide to do anything tomorrow, it'll be written up.
Mm-hmm.
If 50 students from a small Catholic school in Minnesota or Nebraska do anything, no one pays any attention to it, and the social scientists never do studies of it.
The SNCC people wanted people with the background.
They wanted those people from the Northeast and up. And this, by the way, when I found out about this, which I did almost accidentally once, Dottie told me that I was horrified. That's the prerogative of some white man, supposed to be horrified. But they very definitely wanted people related to the Bingham family, people related to Arthur Schlesinger, you know what I mean? People who were in a position to move the establishment politically. Let me finish with
okay.
the motives.
Oh yeah.
And then vanity and egoism and going and a trip, personal trip in that sense of the word. At that time, you didn't have that expression. But you know, all of those motives,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we ought to find that peculiar about them, given what motivates people to do anything, especially to write books,
right.
and become, you know, college professors or anything. But that's, I think, the whole range. Mm-hmm. of George Eliot could do a good job describing the complexity of these motives in a novel like Middlemarch. But that's the range. But
what about how the volunteers interacted with themselves? Was there a lot of good feeling immediately, or I mean, when did a? I guess what I'm asking is, when did a collective identity occur? Was that quickly, or was that?
I think it was hastened by those deaths, the news of the disappearance. But I think people rushed to that because that's the one thing that they could find to hold them together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're anxious. There's some great mystery and enigma facing them. Whole state of Mississippi, etc., etc. And what better way to deal with that than come together as a big, large group of people who are frightened and anxious and waiting for Condo or whatever they were waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think rather quickly. Some of that also facilitated by the attention they were getting. It's almost as if, you know, when you're on stage, you kind of huddle almost. I don't mean this in any pejorative way, the way I'm describing it. I'm just describing it rather than criticizing
right.
it. But I think, you know, that self-consciousness and the attention of others visited upon them facilitated or pushed along that kind of collective response of people to one another.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, after all, these very moving things that were going on, the singing of the songs, the holding of the hands, the circle. I mean, this is very powerful, emotional stuff,
mm-hmm.
with death hovering, and anxiety, and mystery, and confusion. very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask.
I do not mean in the frivolous sense.
Right.
Of dramatic.
Yeah. Go ahead. Let me ask you about a couple of people that I've been focusing on. Did you know Paul or Jeffrey Cowan?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me some things about them?
I've known them for a long time.
Okay.
They both were from Harvard, and they were newspaper writers already then in the Crimson. Paul keeps on writing. Jeff has become a lawyer. Have you interviewed them, by the way?
No.
Are you going to try to?
Well, I'm running out of time.
You've got enough to do. If you need help, I could.
Carol's written
number of
books that touch on it. A couple chapters or something.
Right. And he's in New York, and their father had been connected with television and radio. Their mother's a very rich woman from the Spiegel mail order company in Chicago. She used to lead a group of women to these weekdays in Mississippi. They'd fly down from New York to Jackson, and it was something. And it enraged me because, they get off the plane, you think they were landing in the heart of darkness itself, and I said, listen, folks, it's safer in this Jackson airport than in New York City, the way you're behaving, as if, give these people a little credit for, it was kind of an ignorance there.
Mm-hmm.
I felt, of course, the whole project, some of those students could have done more with the white communities in those towns, but of course one of the ways they protected themselves was to totally exclude themselves from that. Anyway, yes, I knew them, and it was quite clear why they were valuable to people. What do you want to know? What are they like?
Yeah.
They were protégés at the time of David Reisman, and he was very fond of both of them. They were very intelligent and articulate, and very well connected and very earnest. Paul, I think, was in Canton. Isn't that where he was during the
project? Yeah.
Right, and I remember visiting him. I was going around from Freedom House to Freedom House. One of my sons was born that summer, August 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Canton. He was a very able member of that Freedom House. And I would describe him of the two as the most, he's more emotional of the two brothers, but very idealistic and determined. Jeff is a very sweet guy, too. I think he's a lawyer. I don't know where, but he was, they were good, solid kids at the time, 18, 19, 20.
Do you think they'd be fair examples of a larger set?
I don't know how to describe this without being crude and sociological. I would say they were among the more valuable to the SNCC people. They were the richer and better connected than just about anyone there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were especially valuable. They were not typical. They were typical of a certain group, a very small group. They were the elite, to be blunt about it.
Mm-hmm.
Disgusting as it is, they were the elite.
He's weird to talk about the elite of the summer volunteer.
Well, let's face it, though. I think, where do you put this consciously, unconsciously? I'll bet in the minds of those who organized that, they knew who those brothers were and what that meant. Yeah.
I have an interview report which says about Jeffrey Cowan that the interview went fair, and she noticed a substantial degree of arrogance, but she was willing to overlook that, but she said his father is CBS. So I mean,
they do.
Yeah,
now.
Sure. Let's.
You know who were the least arrogant members of that Mississippi Summer Project?
Mm-hmm.
The people that they had least need of. Some of these white kids I remember who had come from Lutheran colleges in Minnesota and Catholic colleges in Nebraska and Minnesota. They were sweetheart people. They were wonderful. But. They weren't prancing around, and they didn't have important telephone numbers unlisted in their black books.
Mm-hmm. Do you think those kids got along with the...
I think there were class divisions within this, both black and white, and I've never seen them remarked upon in the whole literature, the historical literature of the civil rights movement. That is always toned down as these racial tensions are discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Class within the whites, never mind blacks, poor, whites, rich.
Right.
I mean poor and working class background. Class within even the college backgrounds. Snotty Ivy League arrogance, which after all doesn't only demonstrate itself when you're being interviewed for going to the Mississippi Summer Project. It's a part of the carriage of an entire life. It's demonstrated and considered an asset when these same people are applying to law firms. Or to get into a graduate school, whatever, or never mind to get into the colleges they get into. So you can't just, that's what I feel is wrong in a lot of these write-ups. A lot of these descriptions, psychological, sociological, whatever, are ripped out of the context of life. This isn't just arrogance, you know, in connection with blacks or whatever. This is built-in structural, you know, arrogance. And the reports that always emphasize when the split started taking place, you know, black, white, black power, you can't trust whites, whites, this, whites, that. What about some of the, not only whites who are so different from whites, but this is another thing that I don't see often enough discussed, the class divisions among the blacks. Those blacks who were savvy and well-connected one way or another, maybe not rich, but well-connected to money and power and manipulations of one sort or another, all too congenial to the rest of us, and those who weren't. And the difference, say, between Stokely Carmichael on the one hand and John Lewis on the other, these are important distinctions, blurred by all that talk at the time of black power and all those racial fights that became well-publicized. And the more they were publicized again, the more it became theater.
Mm-hmm.
And people are on stage and they take rhetorical positions. And then it gets a momentum of its own and there can be no healing. Because, you know, they're standing there and every word is going to be reported in the New York Times and they're beholden now to that posture. There's no pulling back.
Mm-hmm.
And they're screaming at one another, and then they're getting more publicity for screaming, and the ones who scream the loudest get the most publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who are most articulate and better able to handle this with the reporters get even more publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And publicity itself becomes an obsession, and in fact becomes a whole purpose in living, as we well know, apart from race in this society, for all of us.
Okay.
One speech after
another. Let's... Okay, let's move on to then this summer. What were your sort of responsibilities? Did you still have responsibilities, or was this?
I was a doctor. I was going around from one Freedom House to the next in Macomb. I had to take, his name Dennis Sweeney. I drove him from Macomb to Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
At 100 miles an hour.
Have you...
In my car.
This is sort of aside from the actual interview. Have you read Dreams Die Hard? The Harris's book about... you know what I'm talking about, though?
Yes.
Because one of the things I'm very curious about is Harris gives, I guess... sort of three strands of argument or motives for the murder. And I guess the first one would be the homosexual, which has been very controversial. The second one is...
I don't think that's why he killed him.
The second one...
he would have killed someone else. In fact, he was in... Did you know that he wanted to kill Ed Pincus?
Right, right.
And so it's not the homosexual. Go on.
The second one...
I know, I am a psychiatrist, by the way. Go on. Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead. What's the
second one? I think was basically just the paranoia that he had about the radio transmitter, and
he had paranoia,
and that it was connected with Mozart. But the third one that interests me, and which he kind of just sort of leaves on the table, is that and the reason I wanted to ask you about it is because you write about it too, the sense of community that Sweeney found in Mississippi, and that Sweeney found again in the sort of communal living that he found in the resistance movement. And he never had that again after that. Right. And he sort of was a wayward soul.
That's right. That's what I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you this. When I met him the first time in Macomb, and I drove him back and tried to figure out whether I needed to get a doctor because he had some ear trouble due to the blast, the dynamite, I heard him say some things. I made an immediate diagnosis. I said to my wife on the phone, I said, I think he's schizophrenic. And she said, what do you mean? I said, I heard the way he was talking, there were some lapses in what we call, in my profession, there are lapses of the thinking disorder, lapses, where the thoughts don't follow in some way, that you get a little frightened by some of the things that the person says that don't quite make sense. You don't have to be a shrink to notice that. Mm-hmm. But a little of that came out, perhaps under the stress, and so I thought, okay, maybe there's some real psychotic stuff in him, but it'll recede. But then, of course, I noticed that it never totally receded, and I think people have a capacity to get along with someone like that, provided it is, after all, he's a very intelligent, thoughtful, decent, lovely kid, and but boy, later on, we were living in New Mexico. I was getting calls every other day from people in Seattle, and it's clear that this is 11 years ago that he was crazy as could be. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then I had a deal with Ed Pincus. I told him, I'm the one that Ed turned to when I said, Ed, he asked me, he said, do you think he will ever deliver on these threats? I said, I do. I think he's quite possible. You know, Ed Pincus moved out of Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Up to Vermont. Mm-hmm. He would have been the one. He would have killed him. Mm-hmm. He was telling him he was going to kill him. I said, you better get out. He said, would you? I said, oh boy, would I? I said, or I get him locked up. Mm-hmm. I think if I hadn't pulled away, you know, they was going to send him down to Albuquerque to stay with him. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I couldn't take it. I had a wife and three children. I was doing work with Indians and Spanish-speaking people with Mexico. I said, I can't take someone else. Mm-hmm. My youngest boy at the time was 2 years old. I said, well, you know, I'm not running he's got to get a doctor. Right. He's got to have a life. And we can't just take people in a small adobe house in the North Valley of Albuquerque. But I'll tell you, if we had, in other words, that's why I absolutely discount the homosexual thing and the paranoia thing. I think paranoia finds objects for itself indiscriminately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the third one is, I think, very important. Mm-hmm. This was a home, and he was given love and support and attention, and the best of him came out. And then it all fell apart, and all he was left with was this other stuff. I think if it hadn't been for his involvement in the civil rights movement and in the anti-war movement, he would have gotten sicker earlier, because often schizophrenia develops very floridly in late adolescence. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Can you describe some of the Freedom Houses for me? The general feeling that you got going into
it? Well, there was a lot of excitement. Again, there were always incidents. The reporters were there all the time. They had people with typewriters and bulletin boards and people going in and out. A lot of that activity I thought was a little bit pitched and not very and wasted, but why wouldn't it be? I mean, their very presence there was really the point they were making. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of that. And then there were the usual human squabbles and intrigues. Sexual, social, personality clashes, but also a great deal of positive, affectionate stuff going on. And then some of the ironies that I've pointed out, the enormous awe and the affection that some of the white kids developed for the black people who were putting them up, which contradicted their whole notion of what they were down there for. Because I would sit and listen to them describing how wonderful these people are, and then I said, once to myself, these people are so wonderful, Mississippi can't be so bad. they kept on saying these are the most wonderful people in the world.
But talking about the which family?
The black families were putting them up, and these are supposedly the most persecuted people in America, and yet they were describing as the most wonderful people in America. And once I brought that up, actually, with Paul Cowan, who I thought could take it, and also I felt it's a little safe with him to have this kind of discussion. I said, Paul, you keep on saying how wonderful these people are, and you're supposedly here to liberate them. It sounds like they're liberating you.
Mm-hmm.
He laughed, and, you know, was taken a little aback by it, as I was taken aback by the whole damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if I may use this expression, isn't it all black and white? Because
mm-hmm.
after all, they were very enamored of the dignity and courage, friendliness and hospitality and goodwill and affectionate side of supposedly this much persecuted race of people,
mm-hmm.
which is not said by me in order to justify anything. But it just brought up, in other words, the kind of ironies and paradoxes and inconsistencies and difficulties that who is best equipped to explain to us? Novelists,
mm-hmm.
not social scientists. Novelists. People who understand, you know, as Faulkner and Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor and others have understood that in the midst of all this sadness and horror are also tremendous aspects of human triumph, but often people who have more, no matter what their skin color, are black. Color is black. That was going on. In other words, these kids were being educated. They were being surprised. They were being puzzled. They were at times frightened. They had excluded themselves, I think, more than might have been the case necessarily. They excluded themselves from the white world, and not that the white world wanted anything to do with them. They were provocative to the white world in their dress and mannerism. Sometimes I thought overly so in order to show themselves and the whole world. These are the people, many of you know, whom we come from. Place it up there, and we now will have nothing to do. We are blacks. You know,
right.
Anything to do with white people. Mm-hmm. I used to watch them going to the post office at times, and I thought, well, you know, some of this is just a little overdone.
Mm-hmm.
But then maybe that showed you something about basically frightened member of the American middle class I am. Anyway, mm-hmm. that's what some of what was going on. They were learning an enormous amount about mm-hmm. the state of Mississippi and particular neighborhoods. They were establishing friendships. They were initiating projects, education projects, health projects, civic and political activist projects toward that original goal of
right.
voter registration. Not that they were registering people, but, you know, political education, whatever. And that was all going on day after day.
Mm-hmm.
And there were repeated incidents. There was one incident, I don't know if you saw that, but it was made the front page of the Times.